Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 12, Manager and Cayman Island Director Issues, Micro Session. Jed Wider, Patrick Head from Maples and Calder, and Abilie Hoylette from Maples Fiduciary will discuss certain Cayman Island legal issues pertaining to hedge fund managers and Cayman Island directors. Now, on to the podcast.
A good place to start is really asking, you know, what is also the appropriate governing law for a lot of these issues. Obviously, Cayman directors face multiple jurisdictions with the funds they work in, but I think helpfully from our perspective is a recent New York court decision in Davis which supported that in respect of, say, claims for breach of fiduciary duty, that it was Cayman Islands laws that appropriate jurisdiction. The framework is made up of a combination of statutory rules. Obviously, the company's law is the most sort of relevant there. Common law duties, both fiduciary and non-fiduciary. Fiduciary duties are ones which people, I'm sure, are very familiar with. Those, you know, really are of loyalty, honesty, good faith. That really means that directors must act bona fide for a proper purpose, have an unfettered discretion in the way they act, and seek to avoid conflicts. In addition, they have a sort of core non-fiduciary duties of care, diligence, and skill. In addition to those, there's CEMA, which is the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, is a local regulator, has also issued a statement of guidance. And that really is the only sort of relevant, I guess, quasi-regulation that directly relates to directors' duties with respect to regulated investment hedge funds in the Cayman Islands. The statement of guidance itself is, while it was not necessarily directly enforceable, I think CEMA would look to that to determine whether or not a fund is being operated in a fit and proper manner. The statement of guidance does set out, in addition to the sort of statutory and the common law duties, a number of duties that CEMA considers applicable to a director of a professional fund or investment fund in Cayman. Those would include exercising independent judgment. The director is obviously responsible for appointing and removal of service providers, for reviewing the terms in which service providers are appointed, understanding the scope and nature and the roles of the different service providers, and then how that directly relates to what the director's roles are on the fund, ensuring that service providers are performing their functions in accordance with the contractual terms on which they're appointed. Directors obviously maintain responsibility, but they have to do that and, I guess, discharge their duties by regularly monitoring what service providers are doing and what the delegated functions are, how they're being carried out, and ensuring they're being carried out in accordance with the contractual nexus that service providers have been appointed to do. So really the statement of guidance is one in its core of oversight, particularly of service providers, and an emphasis on directors' active and ongoing supervision. And then I guess the final piece of the puzzle really from a Cayman regulatory point of view is the relevant case law. The lead case in that regard is Weavering, which people may be aware of. It's where two individual directors were found liable to the tune of $111 million personally. It was subsequently overturned, but the case did set out a broad range of sort of duties that the court would expect to see, and it really establishes a test for when a director has been acting willfully in default of their duties, and that essentially is where they knowingly or intentionally breach their duties, or their actions are so reckless that they just simply do not care. I mean, the judge made quite an interesting comment that a director could be effectively incompetent at their job, but so long as they weren't reckless in doing it and didn't knowingly intend to be incompetent, then they can't be held to be willfully at default or willfully negligent. So, you know, to be fair, that is quite a handle that a lot of directors will point to and will want with, you know, back to the Davis case of Cayman Islands law governing. They want to know that as a backstop, it's quite a high, or sorry, effectively a low bar that a director does need to meet before they can be found to be liable. But the case did again point out that directors must be proactive. They cannot simply assume that delegated service providers have performed all of their core functions without need for supervision. that directors need to understand the nature and the scope of the work and the role that each of the service providers are playing in a fund, that obviously the board meetings should be convened for substance and not simply convened to rubber stamp matters. And effectively, the directors must be active and not passive in discharging what effectively is just a high supervisory level of control. So that, in a frame, that essentially is the Cayman framework.
Who are the duties owed to by Cayman directors?
So the duties are principally owed to the company itself in this context. So they're not owed directly to shareholders. They're not owed to creditors, save in exceptional circumstances. Then obvious would be where a company may be near insolvency, and then directors do have an obligation to take into consideration the interests of creditors in that situation. But it's an interesting interplay if you get onto topics like side letters. The director's duty, as I mentioned, are to the company, not to any one particular shareholder. So there's an inherent tension there with discharging those duties.
Abelie, talk to us about the roles and duties of an independent director.
All right. Well, as Patrick highlighted, and you would have gathered, it really isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to providing governance services. A lot of our duties and activities are determined or dictated by the language in the fund documents, the culture of the IM, and also the infrastructure of the IM. So, we spend a lot of time getting to understand the investment manager, who they are, sort of what their internal infrastructure is, to then map out a plan as to what our oversight function will be and how we're going to go about that. I think, the simple thing is, we are expected to exhibit a reasonable skill and care, and ultimately we're expected to exhibit impartial and objective input as we provide oversight to the investment vehicles and the service providers. One thing I would note, though, Jed, is, while we are charged with acting in the best interest of the fund, certainly at Maples FS, because we have 18 individuals providing directors and certainly have a significant market share, we're often looked at, to provide life cycle support. We have a lot of insight as to best practice, and, a lot of ODD consultants and their investors, reach out to us. So oftentimes managers that we work with or have relationships with reach out to us to gain some insight there.
What elements of a fund help to facilitate the effective oversight that you might play with respect to a fund as a director?
In simple terms, having clear and concise language in the fund documents is the best starting place. We spend a lot of time looking at that, providing comments, working with onshore and offshore counsel, just to make sure that the fund documents themselves are clear. Investors are fully aware of what they're getting into. Beyond that, communication lines have to be solid, have to be open. Having access to information and full transparency also help us to provide proper oversight. And then I think a lot of times it is understated the importance of quality service providers. It doesn't make sense to spend all the time drafting documents if the service providers that are going to be used don't have the proper processes or the capacity in place to monitor and adhere to those documents.
Let's turn to sort of the issue of unexpected situations. And so what should a director do when a director is presented with an unexpected situation? Let's start with that.
Yeah, so you got to gather all the information. I think at the end of the day, attempting to make a decision without being informed, could be the first misstep. So making sure that you have all the information, making sure that you take a look at the fund documents. After all, spending all that time and money putting the fund documents in place, it seems senseless to not look at those. At the end of the day, those form the basis for any decision that you need to make. And then getting fund counsel involved, whether or not it's for advice or simply to document the decision-making process and the decision that's made.
In terms of the issues that are appropriate for a manager to bring, now let's say there is an unexpected situation. At what point does a manager realize which particular issues are appropriate to bring to a director, to notify the director, and what are those issues? What types of issues do you feel would fall into the camp of not necessary to bring to us?
Largely speaking, it depends on the language within the docs, but we spend a lot of time at the onset when we're establishing a relationship, communicating and indicating that, we would like to be brought into the loop at early stages, whether or not you're talking to a potential investor and you get the feeling that there could be a side letter involved, that would be something that you should reach out to the board with and, perhaps get Cayman Council involved. You know, there have been a few nuances in a few court cases with, I guess, sort of slight slip-ups because managers didn't bring those to the attention of the board. There may be other instances, whether or not it relates to a particular security. Sometimes it may not be the evaluation itself of the security that is the issue, but sort of the knock-on effects. Maybe have capital activity that's expected and, you know, wanting to make sure that the board is aware, and if indeed, you know, we need to make a decision before sort of a redemption deadline, you know, at least we'll be able to do so. And then sometimes simply a drawdown in performance, you know, whether or not there are the questions about going concern issues. You know, it's always best to get the board involved there so that there can be an orderly wind-up, orderly liquidation of affairs. And for us, you know, that is important because we then sort of ask the question whether or not there are any parallel vehicles and, you know, understand how that liquidation process takes place.
And I think that's it comes back to, sorry to interrupt you, it comes back to the that delegation point and having, as you mentioned, the clear roles crafted out inside the actual documentation that's setting out the scope of the service providers so that, you know, from a director's point of view, I think they can understand what is it that the director is actually, what the IM's taking responsibility for, what's left on my plate, what does it say that the administrator is responsible for, and having the documentation be clearly drafted, to have clear guidelines as to what the policies are and who's responsible for the various pieces, then I think allows for that better flow of communication as to when something unexpected arises, whether it's outside of the four corners of the agreement to raise it at an early time. I mean, obviously we find, you know, directors can find themselves in hot water fairly quickly if they just aren't informed. I think today with, you know, more sophisticated investors, they're also very quick to bring issues to light and to ask questions of the manager and directors. I think it's quite often now you see investors want to ask questions directly, you know, of the directors and to understand what their thoughts are on certain points, and so almost a second wave of diligence for them. So it's I think in that sense it's always evolving. It's this obligation to be constantly informed and constant oversight, to be proactive.
So if things fall apart, let's say there's great disparity with respect to the approach that the manager wants to take with respect to a significant issue. Directors are not on board. They do not agree with that decision. What steps can the directors take to unwind the partnership, to dissolve the partnership? What steps can the manager take on the flip side if they're not pleased with the decisions by their directors to remove a director?
I think it's a hard question because it's always going to be very fact-specific. I mean, from a legal point of view, you would always immediately turn to the contractual arrangements, you would look at the constitutional documents, you would look at the terms of the delegation agreements, the investment management agreement. You would look whether or not there's been a technical breach. It may be the case that the directors, if they're professionally employed, they will also be under a service agreement. There would be termination provisions in there. So immediately we'd turn to the documentation and say, well, how can I look to enforce one of these provisions? Has somebody actually breached the term of an agreement? If it's more of a case that the director is just continually second-guessing the IAM's decisions and they're just fed up with it, then it's more difficult as to what you can do. But quite often, I think from a structural point of view, you know, really today we would have funds that where the investors have all of the voting control. So ordinarily, the manager should retain the voting administrative control of the fund. So quite often, the manager will have the ability to simply fire or remove a director under the terms of the document. So you would look to pose that, and that can be for a no-cause reason as well. There may well be some sort of penalty under a service agreement, but that may be worth it. I think before that, it's a case of identifying quite what the issue is, seeing if it's arisen from a conflict situation, you know, how that can be mitigated. And at that point, it's really a case, I think, of process. It's a case of putting in place a robust process so that from a regulatory sort of point of view, from a regulator looking in, from an investor's point of view looking in, they're comfortable that the board has stepped up to put in, and with the investment manager, put in place a robust process to examine what the issue is. And quite often, if it's a conflict point, you may look to isolate the manager's executive director on the board. The board may call a meeting. They'll tell all of the directors, this meeting's been called to discuss putting you in a corner. You know, we will look to form a committee that committee would be the remaining independent directors, say, to review the situation. They may well need to look at bringing in other professional advisors to assist them with resolving what that conflict is. And quite often that makes managers nervous because they feel they're losing a bit of control over their own fund at that time. But invariably that's actually for both the interests of the investor and also the interest of the manager. Slightly outside my wheelhouse, but I mean, talking with litigation colleagues, yeah, investors have been successful in bringing down funds simply because there hasn't been a robust process in place to deal with a conflict situation like that. So the actual merits of the underlying claim may be right or wrong. That's sort of outside the question at that point. It's more, how are you currently dealing with it? There isn't a robust process. The regulator's unhappy. The claim's upheld in court. The fund's pulled apart simply because there wasn't a process. I think at that point, it's a case of the board really stepping up. That is when the independent directors are really earning their pay and when it's beneficial, I think, for managers to have independent directors. To show the world at large.
And I think, you know, before it even gets to that stage, one of the things that we sort of look at is the managers are appointed, you know, to run the day-to-day activities of the fund. The investors have done their research on the manager's performance, and at the end of the day have placed some level of comfort there in the manager. So, you know, our aim, you know, really is to be helpful and to, you know, assist with remaining on side and, you know, certainly, you know, keeping the business going.
Good. All right, well, I think that we're out of time. Pat, Abilene, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.